Okay, this is 22nd June 1976 at the AAS meeting in Haverford, talking with Robert Dickey. And maybe if you can just tell me a little bit about your educational background during the Rad Lab or before.
Well, let's see, I started as an undergraduate at the University of Rochester, transferred as a junior to Princeton, and then went back to Rochester for my graduate work. Again, it was in physics. I got my PhD in 1941.
I see. And what field was that, microwave?
That was physics. It was nuclear physics thesis, uh-huh. Actually. It's the only nuclear physics I ever did, was that thesis.
And then you moved into the Rad Lab, I guess, when the war began.
Well, actually, before the war, I went to the radiation laboratory in, 1941, I guess, mm-hmm. September 41.
And what was your main responsibilities there and so forth?
Well, I was assigned to the, I think it was called the Fundamental Developments Group under the leadership of Ed Purcell of Harvard. And we were supposed to be about five jumps ahead of the other groups. Mm-hmm. And when I arrived, they were working on 3-centimeter radar and then got into the development of 1-centimeter radar after that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had input to a number of areas.
And
magic T, symmetric junctions, things of that kind.
And what would you say you specifically, was all of this, I always think of you in terms of low noise and receivers, was that sort of your specialty, would you say, during the war?
Well, not exactly. It was, as I said, I was in a number of areas. The connection with my interest in antenna design, which was to worry about the antenna pattern of the feed. At the time I started, they just took the overall antenna and mm-hmm. worried about its pattern. And I broke this down into two parts, one, the pattern of the feed, and then what the reflector would do to that pattern.
Right.
And so I was interested in measuring a radiation from feeds, and I developed a sensitive little probe for that purpose, so it wouldn't disturb the field.
I see.
And that used a locking amplifier. I guess one of the real first uses of a locking amplifier. And I was impressed with what the locking amplifier was capable of doing, fishing signal on noise.
Mm-hmm.
And then it occurred to me one day that by opening up the band of the IF, you should be able to produce a very sensitive detector of microwave radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So I built a model of that kind. And then the model worked so well, and actually we made some water vapor measurements with that crude red bulb model.
Now, would this wide banding have been of any use for the military applications? It would seem to me that.
Well, they were regular wide band receivers that were used for microwaves anyway. But the normal thing that you think of in improving signal noise is the narrow band.
Right.
For purposes of improving the signal noise.
Right.
Here, the trick was the wide band before you detect, and then narrow band afterward.
I see what
and
you're
saying, And that seemed to be the new contribution.
Right.
And then we, since the breadboard worked well, we designed, a little better engineered, three versions of the radiometer, one at 1 centimeter, 1 1/4, and 1 1/2. And took those three to Florida to get a measure of the water vapor absorption problem, mm-hmm. which was already looming as a difficult problem.
In the Earth's atmosphere?
Yes. Yeah.
And what did you, this is still during the war you're talking about now.
Yeah.
What did you find from that?
Well, we had a measure of the contribution of the water vapor, which was quite good. And out of that measurement, there's also an upper limit on the radiation coming in from beyond the atmosphere. I forgot what the number was, some 20 degrees or something mm-hmm. like that.
And this is what you're referring to as in a Rad Lab book?
That is a paper published in the Physical Review.
Well, that's the one with, who are they, Behringer?
Yeah, Behringer, Bain, and Kyle.
Right.
And I think the upper bound on the radiation coming in from space
is 20 kelvins or something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And about the same time, one night, I scanned around the sky on a conical scan to see what kind of isotropy measure you could get for radiation coming in from outer space. You got to set a limit about 1 degree on that.
And you were telling me this is published in one of the Rad Lab books, but it's not credited, but you can't remember which article.
The only thing that's there, as I recall now, is that in the Rad Lab series, there is a picture which is said to be picture produced with a radiometer, which scans around the sky at several different elevations, mm-hmm. so that you first see the horizon, see the contributions of the buildings, and a little higher.
Oh, I see.
You get dips as you hit the buildings.
Oh, I see.
And finally up so high that you're missing the building.
Huh.
But that's, the numbers that are in that figure are not the ones on which this, are not the best measures of the isotropy, because one night I just spent the whole night, if you like, or hours at least, just scanning around at an angle of 45 degrees to get a good measure of that.
Yeah, but
and
never,
that's unpublished.
You never published that.
No, that's unpublished.
You might have some notes on it, possibly, then, somewhere. When did you learn of Reber's and Jansky's work? Did you know about this? Was this common knowledge at the Rad Lab?
Yes, that was known. It was also known that, what was his name at Bell Labs?
Southworth.
Southworth.
Yes.
Had been able to detect the radiation from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
His radiometer arcs are so much more sensitive that you could bang it off scale with the sun.
Yeah.
You got radiation from the sun, from the moon. Quite a decent signal of noise on the radiation from the moon with an antenna that was no more than, I don't know what we had, it was maybe 14 inches across, something like that, or a little parabola.
And these were the first absolute measurements also.
As the first absolute measurement I know of radiation from the moon.
Right, or of any kind, really.
Yeah.
But now, you knew about Southworth's work, but you did not repeat it during the war anyway. Did you wait until
the
end?
Well, my impression was that Southworth stuff came maybe 6 months or so before we did it. I don't remember mm-hmm. I remember hearing about Southworth stuff before this. I can't remember how much.
Yeah. Was there a Bell Labs report, do you know, on Southworth's work? I've only seen an article which he published finally just at the end of the war.
I think I saw, I can't remember at this late date whether I saw a lab report or whether I saw an article.
It was a journal of the Franklin Institute.
I think it was a published article I saw, a reprint of it.
Okay, that's probably it. Now, what about your own radio astronomy work? Were there any internal Rad Lab reports relevant to this?
Well, there was certainly an internal Rad Lab report with described the radiometer.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recall any that described the measurements that we made.
Hmm. Were there any wartime reports that you can remember to do with accidental detection of the sun, how it might cause interference with radars and things like this?
No, usually the contribution of the sun is a rather minor one.
At these high frequencies,
Well, it's not only that, it's just even if you pointed right at the sun, this would increase the noise figure of the receiver, the poor receivers that we had at that time by at most 3 dB. So it would still work quite well.
Right.
That was not a problem.
But that was because you were working at such high frequencies. I mean, for instance, Hay, in his accidental detection that he figured out, the English radars were at a couple meters or something. Bursts were much more important then.
Oh, the pace of bursts, yes. At the high frequencies, you wouldn't see the bursts.
Right, you don't have them, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
It'd only be the thermal radiation. I remember when our measurements, that we looked at the eclipse of the sun, and that was published. A word of it, I guess I described it actually at a physical society meeting in Washington. The newspaper reporters were there, and I pointed out that the temperature we got was not the 5,000 or 6,000 degrees, mm-hmm. but 10,000, pointing out that the radiation was coming from higher in the atmosphere where the temperature was different.
Right.
There was a reporter there that didn't get the point. So there were huge headlines in the newspapers in Boston. Sun observed to be 4,000 degrees hotter than previously thought.
Getting hotter. Yeah. can you describe, I'm familiar with that short Apjay article, in 46 I guess it was.
And the eclipse.
Yes, mm-hmm. and also just the moon measurement, I think, is in that same article. Can you describe those observations, what the conditions were? You were up on a roof, I think, at MIT. And you just tell me that story?
Yes, well, we had an eclipse was due to start reasonably early in the morning, I think. And so we dragged, I think didn't get the apparatus going until after it was underway. And had the apparatus set up on the roof lab. Actually on the roof, I think, of one of the temporary labs, the radiation laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a parabolic antenna, if I remember right, of some 14, 16 inches in diameter. and just followed it. I think that same antenna was used for the moon measurements.
Yes, I think so, yeah. And then you didn't do anything more with it when the war ended?
No, I made an attempt to get a cooperative program going with the astronomy department.
Yes, can you tell me about that?
When I went there with we didn't get any encouragement. The astronomers didn't seem to be all that anxious. And so I felt I better get on with my physics research.
Did they know about Reber or Jansky, the astronomers? Do you remember?
I think they must have known about it. But that was a time, 1946, Russell was getting very near retirement. And Spitzer and Schwarzschild weren't there yet.
Mm-hmm.
It was a period of changeover.
Yeah, yeah. What about, were there any of your colleagues in the Rad Lab who were interested in radio astronomy or tried to do any experiments, maybe unpublished? Do you remember any?
I don't recall anyone. The first one to really use his radiometer technique was not one of the group of us that were involved with it, but it was Purcell, who, as I said, was my group leader and was impressed with this thing. He designed an equipment to look for the 21-centimeter line using the same technique. And led to the discovery of the 21-centimeter line.
Right. Was he thinking about this during the war, are you saying?
No,
I guess he didn't know about the prediction of the line at that time. Yeah, so it took a few years for him to start working on that.
That was after the war, maybe 2 years after
he
broke up or something like that. The other two radiometers, I think one went with Beringer to Yale. I don't know what happened to the third one. And I don't believe Beringer did anything more than break it up for components as I did ours. I had the 1.25-centimeter radiometer. And with that equipment and with a little more sense as to what I should have been doing with it, I could have gotten beautiful measurements on the moon over a whole lunar cycle, for example, back in 1946.
Right. Okay, well, do you have any comments on why American radio astronomy did not take off like British and Australian radio astronomy did in the late 40s?
I don't know, only a prejudice on my part. I think that the people that were involved in the development of the microwaves in our country were ones that didn't have the background or interest in astronomy. And astronomers didn't have that contact with electronics.
Yeah. Well, that was true in the other countries also, the latter.
Yeah. I don't know why you'd say it would be different over there, but who were the leaders? Rather interesting. One of the leaders here was Bart Bach, who got his motivation, I would guess, in part from the fact he was rather close to Ed Purcell.
But this was somewhat later, though. I'm talking about the late 40s.
Yeah, right.
Before the
early
50s.
See this. But Ed Purcell's work on the 21-centimeter line was quite shortly after that. It must have been 48 or somewhere in there.
Well, no, the discovery was 51.
Was it that late?
Yeah. And I don't know when he actually began. I haven't
talked
to him.
Well, it might have been that late. Yeah. My remembrance of the time is way off. But
who?
It was, I think, Bart's interest in what Purcell was doing that got him interested.
Oh, yeah, that was certainly important, indeed. Who were the leaders of the microwave that, if they had an interest in astronomy, might have been able to...
I should have been doing something. I could have done it. Beringer could have done it.
Of course, it could have even been low frequency. It didn't have to be microwave. The stuff that Ryle and the Australian, Pawsey and the Australians was all very low frequency, 1 meter sort of stuff. Radio sources and all this sort of thing. No one picked this up.
I guess maybe the basic motivation, the people that had the knowledge and ability to do the electronics, as I said, had strong backgrounds in nuclear physics, particle physics,
things
of that kind, and they were rather more concerned with the laboratory type physics.
Right, they were not ionospheric,
they were not really,
sort of physicists. You know, that makes sense. Now,
But I think the same thing could be said about Australians, and why it happened there is... I had a visit one time from, Paul's name instead of P, Pawsey.
Pawsey. Yes.
And Pawsey was thinking about getting into this business. He came to Princeton and talked to me about that radiometer.
When was this now?
And it was shortly after the war.
Mm-hmm.
Might have been 48 or so.
Oh, he was in it from the 46, right after the war. He immediately jumped into it. Yeah.
It was very shortly after the war.
Yeah.
I don't think he was really in the business yet, but was just... Or was just getting set up or something.
Yeah, that's
like that.
Probably right. Now, Before we skip all the way up to the background radiation story, is there anything else that you were connected with radio astronomy in that gap of...
Well, only when the Associated Universities Incorporated got together a big committee to talk about what could be done with astronomy, I became interested in what would be a good way of building antennas for it, and considered the possibility of phased arrays of parabolas and aperture synthesis of systems.
And as you said, you weren't aware of Ryle's work when you were,
no,
when you were doing
I
this.
No, I wasn't aware of that.
And what was your perception of American radio astronomy at that time? Was it really hurting?
Well, my perception was that we were behind.
Yeah.
And pretty far behind, in fact.
Now, well, we come to background radiation, and there's a story in Hayes' book on the evolution of radio astronomy, which you probably read a couple pages, in which he talks about a phone call to Burke and this sort of thing, but I'd like to hear it from you.
Yeah, I don't know. There is some... I don't really know exactly what happened there, to tell you the truth. I know what part... I can tell you exactly the relation between our group and Penzias and Wilson.
So just tell me what you know firsthand.
But as to how they found out about our work is I don't really know, because the story that I got from Walter Sullivan was that he had been told that some mutual friend that we described what we were doing to had relayed information to Penzias and Wilson.
He says it's Burke.
And it could have been Burke, for all I know. But then there's another story which has a preprint of a paper having been sent to Penzias and Wilson, and they got the idea from that. We don't know anything about that, so
I
think that story's probably wrong.
I see.
But anyway, what happened was that I had this bee in my bonnet for some time that it went something like this, that as the universe expands, the horizon beyond which you can't see is expanding more rapidly than the galaxies out there, so you keep seeing more and more galaxies, and that's true of all these cosmological models.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was, how could the universe be so organized that everything, when you first come into view, is moving in the right way? Because it seems to imply a causal relationship when there couldn't have been any causal connection. And so I thought, well, one way of getting a causal connection is with an oscillating universe that expands to some maximum size and collapses and then re-expands again. Well, there immediately appeared a problem with that hypothesis, which was that the heavy elements formed in stars in the earlier universe would then be still there. So to avoid that, it was quite clear that if you had some radiation, you compressed it, it would get very hot. The radiation could get, the temperatures would rise so high that it would thermally decompose these heavy elements. And you go back to primitive hydrogen.
That was your motivation.
That was the motivation. And so with thought that that might be a way of cleaning up the gas, cleaning up the stuff, we began to make some back-of-the-envelope measurements as to what the residual temperature of the background radiation could be now. And it was apparent at that time, I only made an estimate of some 20 or 30 degrees for an upper bound on the grounds that much more radiation than that, and the universe would be expanding too much, it would be too closed, you know. The energy density would be too high in the field.
It'd be too open, you mean?
Yeah, you know, it would be, there'd be so much energy density in the universe, that high energy density leads to a closed universe. It's crazy, but the high pressure of the radiation doesn't push the universe apart, it causes it to collapse.
Well, maybe we better go over this afterwards. I don't know.
Yeah, well, anyway,
okay.
There are two things that decelerate the universe. One is just the energy density. And there's a separate contribution which comes from the pressure. And that part goes quite opposite to what you think.
Okay.
Think. It
well,
makes it
I'll have to think
slow
about
down.
That. Now, how did Gamow's work fit into this? Was that influencing you at all?
That wasn't influencing me very much, because it wasn't influencing at all at that point. I heard Gamow talk at Princeton. He gave a colloquium talk back in the late 40s. And I had a very clear recollection of what he had described as a universe starting out with all neutrinos cold. And there was nothing about a hot universe in this. And I'm afraid I didn't read the literature well enough, because I didn't know that he then came around later to a hot universe view.
I see.
So I didn't, at that time, picture any connection.
Right, so you weren't really building on his work.
No, not at all.
In any sense.
No, it was completely independent. Well, then we decided, I got the boys interested in this as something worth doing, so we started to design a radiometer. At the same time, Jim Peebles started to worry about the implications of a hot fireball like this for nuclear, for element formation. And he was unaware of the demo stuff, too. Mm-hmm. And he estimated the helium production. Mm-hmm. And on the grounds of getting anywhere reasonable amounts of helium, he could set rough upper limits on the thermal on the temperature now,
right,
which were well below what I had said earlier. My estimates were based only on energy density.
And what were these numbers roughly?
Well, he was getting, I think in our paper, he had an upper limit of the order of 10 degrees or something like that.
And you had?
I had some 30 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had that radiometer all designed, built. As I recall, the matter almost completely built.
Under your direction, this was?
Well, I was also busy with a solar ablateness about this time, yeah, and I wasn't doing all that much directly on the instrument,
so
I was contributing to the design ideas,
right,
and the construction was completely in the hands of Dave Wilkinson and who was the other one that's the author of that paper? Peter Rall.
Right.
Those two.
Okay.
And all four of us were involved in the design of it, though, what the ideas were going in.
What was special about this instrument that you were?
Well, it was really not all that special. It was a regular Swiss radiometer, but it had some new features, that some new things had come along since the war years that we could incorporate. So it wasn't really just a copy of the mm-hmm. radiometer that I built during the war.
This was the first time you had built one since.
Yeah, it was the first one we built since then.
Yeah, yeah.
So it had a number of new features. That radiometer was almost ready to go, as I recall the matter, when I had a call from Penzias one day, saying he'd heard about our work, and saying that he had some funny stuff that he wasn't understanding, and suggesting that we come over and look at it. And I think, if I remember right, Dave Wilkinson and I went over.
Mm-hmm.
And went over his stuff with it. Well, I went through a chalkboard lecture somewhere along the line there, and I remember that those were hard boys to convince. They were considering all kinds of things, pigeon bird in the antenna.
Yeah.
But anyway, somehow or another, I think we fairly well convinced them. And
They were not thinking at all in terms of this being an astronomical contribution, trying to think of all sorts of instrumental or atmospheric.
Well, there's a long history about that, too. As I remember the matter, they were more or less asked by their management to look into this question because there had been earlier work by Crawford and others in which they tried to trace down the sources of noise in that receiver
because
mm-hmm. they wanted to get the lowest possible noise for their satellite
right.
measurements. And so they did a beautiful job, Penzias and Wilson, of tracking down, looking at the noise from this and noise from that. And the really nice thing they did was to put a helium load on it to give a reference temperature. Mm-hmm. It was very low
right,
that
right.
they put in.
That was essential.
Then they discovered that they had more radiation even relative to that. So after they tracked down all the receiver noise, there still was a part left undesigned. At that point, they thought it was really quite impossible it could be coming in from outer space because of the isotropy they were seeing.
Right.
And the amount was high compared with anything you would estimate for the galaxy and that
right.
sort of thing.
Right.
And then because of this isotropy, it just looked awful much like it was the antenna itself. So they were for a long time convinced that it was noise from their antenna. And they rebuilt the throat of it. They swept mm-hmm. out the pigeon dirt. They
yeah.
tried all number of experiments. They couldn't get it to go away.
Yeah.
I think.
So you pretty much convinced them that this
I think
was
we pretty much convinced
plausible.
Them it was coming
anyway.
In. It was not completely crazy.
And then you followed up with your own measurements. You were a different wavelength.
Yeah, and we got going very shortly after that. And I think our paper was, we didn't rush into print at all with the, I shouldn't say we, it was Dave Wilkinson and Peter Rall, actually.
Right.
They didn't particularly rush into print because long after they had some numbers, they polished them over and looked carefully at systematic errors. There was, must have been at least 6 months after they first had
yeah.
results till they published.
What was the reception of the astronomical community? as to the proposed explanation for this?
It was surprisingly favorable. It was almost immediately the other alternative explanations started appearing, the radiations from galaxies and so on.
Mm-hmm. Herdecke mentioned that measurements of two frequencies in later years and more greatly increased the reliability of the acceptance of the radiation. End of Dickey interview.